Hi, Charisse here with a special announcement. You can now enjoy select episodes of Detailed in video form. That's right. Detailed is now available on RCAT's YouTube channel. Now, you may be thinking, I already listened to the podcast. No need to watch it on YouTube. Well, trust me, if you don't want to miss out, even if you're an avid listener of the podcast, the video format is a completely different experience. Not only is it like hanging out with us, but you also get to hear parts of the conversation that were left on the cutting room floor. You can also see the photos, drawings, and video as we discuss the incredible projects that are featured. Come join us on YouTube. Follow the link in our show notes, and let's get into the details. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
I believe firmly in sort of trusting the people who are doing the project. And if you actually give them that trust and if you give them that power, it actually makes for a better space. Obviously, there's the anal architect in me and, you know, everyone in my team from the US, it's like, they didn't get that detail right. They didn't do this, they did that. And I'm like, they built it in 10 months. They built that building. And, you know, can you imagine anyone here? You wouldn't be able to find a stonemason here. I mean, they're not here.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, Senior Specification Writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Diana Kellogg, architect at Diana Kellogg Architects based in New York City. Known for her commitment to sustainable projects and projects focusing on social impact, Diana got her start in high-end residential design but has evolved, in latter years, into nonprofit and community work. A guiding core principle of her firm is its deference to an existing sense of place and history, creating spaces that provide for communal interconnectivity. Diana received a Master of Architecture from Columbia University and a BA from Williams College. Prior to establishing her own firm in 1992, Diana was associated with the firm of Gluckman Tang Architects and Seldorf Architects. Diana Kellogg Architects' work has been featured in various notable publications, including the New York Times, Dwell, Architectural Digest, and New York Magazine. Diana Kellogg Architects is a registered minority and women-owned business enterprise, and the firm has won multiple international design awards. The project we are talking about today is the Rajkumari Ratnavati Girls' School in Jaisalmer, Rajasthan, India. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Located in the Thar Desert, amidst the golden sands of Jaisalmer in Rajasthan, stands a symbol of both hope and empowerment, the Rajkumari Ratnavati Girls' School, commissioned by the Siddha Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to uplifting the most economically challenged and marginalized communities worldwide. The school is a manifestation of their commitment to fostering development through education. This architectural marvel is more than just a school. It is a catalyst for change.
So it's a very long history, as with most of these projects. I was asked by Michael Dabe from the Cheetah Foundation India to work as an architect on this project. I hadn't been to India. I came on my first trip and I actually brought my 13-year-old daughter and I just fell in love with it. It was actually very interesting to see India through her eyes too. And actually she's been involved in it since and is also always giving me kind of good feedback. So the environment, you know, I met just the loveliest people when I arrived there. Jaisalmer is a very special place, just as it is. And I visited a lot of different schools. And, you know, there's just this kind of amazing, kind of unabashed, like, willingness to learn and curiosity to learn. You know, I think so many of us in the U.S., where we're so privileged, we take education for granted. And we can be a little bit jaded by the idea of, you know, oh, of course I have an education. But it's not, of course I have an education for many, and particularly for these girls. So because of, you know, a whole variety of reasons that have to do with gender norms and whatever things are, it's just a complicated. Also, India, I've learned and grown to love, is such an amazing cultural kind of enigma to somebody like myself. I'm American, and I realize that we are just like fledgling babies in the world. And it's always surprising to me why anyone would ever listen to anything we have to say, because, you know, these countries are centuries old and deep with knowledge and, you know, the natural kind of complications of what's evolved over just so many years. And we frankly don't have that. You know, we are so much younger. Our experiences are much different. They're much more contained. They're much more, the fractions, believe it or not, are not as vast. I just love actually learning about the other cultures, not just because I love art history, art, architecture, but also I really love just the exploration of how human beings function in other places. For example, we in the United States, I think for the most part, have kind of lost our kind of local connections. And in India, anyone can look at somebody and say, that person's from this place. That food is from this place. It's something I think that we all are beginning to lose globally. And so I just find that fascinating about all the projects that I'm, you know, eagerly taking on. You know, to do a project in India, you need to know where you are and you need to know exactly the place you are in Rajasthan. It can't just be, I'm doing a building in Rajasthan. I think that's a lot what's resonated with people, is that this is very particular to Jaisalmer.
The girls called the Thar Desert their home. It was important to embrace the natural surroundings while simultaneously maintaining an inviting atmosphere.
So in this project, it was very important to me to provide, number one, a safe space for these girls, because, you know, it's been interesting because I've gotten criticism from Westerners saying that I didn't provide any windows to the desert. Well, the desert isn't, you know, Scarsdale, Arizona for these people. It's very different. These are young girls who mostly don't leave their homes and they've had the desert all their lives. So I wanted to make an internal space that focused on really being able to be calm, centered, and to really be able to learn. And, you know, in a place, I've actually seen it kind of when I've been at the school, the girls often, I can sort of see them get off the bus and they just like relax when they walk into the space. Because, you know, in some ways it's a fortress, but it also gives sort of a very different perspective because it's really all about the sky. And, you know, what is more enlivening for learning than the vastness of our world? So, you know, I like to think that I accomplished what I wanted to do. And I do know some of the girls have said that when they walk into the space, they feel free. And that's an incredible, incredible compliment.
The fundamental aim of the project was to provide a nurturing environment and security for the girls through education.
there is a very low literacy rate amongst women in general in this part of the world, and particularly for girls. I think often schools aren't safe for them. I think they're also, because of the caste system, because of a variety of things that are just, you know, ingrained in the psyche, you know, they're not valued, which is surprise, surprise. I mean, they're not valued here. So like you can imagine they're not, you know, they're not valued there. Although, you know, I have only experienced enormous amount of love and appreciation by the families for the girls, just naturally. But it's just not a cultural norm to have your daughter achieve. You get married, you become a wife, and that's success. And, you know, as we all know, you can be a wife and be other things. And yeah, that's a message the whole world needs to know.
We were introduced to the project because Diana Kellogg, the architect, is a friend of Equality Now. And we highlighted it as a symbol, really, to show what a beautiful space can do to unlock the dreams and potential of young girls.
This is Mona Sinha, the Global Executive Director of Equality Now, who collaborated with Diana to ensure the creation of a nurturing environment at the highest degree.
This school is built in a very conservative part of Rajasthan. I had the great honor of visiting it, and it is something like that the community has never seen before. And I truly believe that the way it is designed and the space allows the little girls there to really dream of what their future could look like. Because it is a beautifully architectured school. Of course, the curriculum and all of that is very important, but the learning environment to me is what is so impressive, because it's unlike anything that they could have dreamed of.
With the project centered on the empowerment and education of women, Diana looked at feminine symbols across cultures when starting the design, specifically around symbols of strength.
I just started with a basic Google search for, you know, symbols of femininity globally for strength. And then I kind of found that the oval, the ellipse, just kept showing up. And it's not really surprising because it is a womb. It's also an egg. It's also incredibly embracing, sort of like motherly love. Like, I like to think that when people enter the space, they feel like they're embraced and they feel like they're held. And, you know, I think that people have said that to me, that they feel like they've gotten sort of a big hug when they come in. So yeah, that's kind of the genesis of it. And then the other, it sort of expanded from there, because I liked the idea of the repetitive ovals, which actually symbolize to me, or are figuratively the symbol of infinity, and then symbolize to me sort of this continual chain that can wrap around the world, just metaphorically, obviously, but that can be about hope and be about holding hands together, male, female, whatever, and continuing to lift everybody up at the same time. And I just think that that's another thing about the shape, and that was fascinating to me. And then, you know, since I did this, I can't tell you, I've been contacted by all kinds of people who have shown me that there's a group, 64 Yogini Temple, and there is actually 64 of these temples that are the same shape as the school. But I had no idea. And actually, I recently saw a photo that's fascinating to me, that the original villages in Jaisalmer, and there's still some that are there today, but they're on the border of Pakistan, they're circular and they're oval. And, you know, these references come up and up and up with, you know, people sending me pictures of buildings in Saudi Arabia or everywhere that have this. I mean, look, if we as architects, we only have so many shapes that we can use, but it's kind of amazing that these shapes show up.
As one can imagine, navigating exterior design to accommodate extreme desert temperatures involves careful assessment. Diana turned to the local architecture in the region to approach the construction of the exterior. Constructed with meticulous detail using hand-cut sandstone, the school seamlessly blends into the rustic charm of its surroundings.
So a couple of things were a given. You know, we were not going to have them air conditioned. We have no windows per se. I mean, there's no glazing anywhere. That's not practical. There's too much sand. You know, also in terms of considering the enclosure and the temperature in the building, you know, they come from un-air conditioned homes. And so my objective was to make it as comfortable as possible and more comfortable than their homes they were used to, but certainly not bringing it up to standards that maybe, you know, part of the other communities that they're not used to, because quite frankly, they would be sick if they were in like ultra air conditioned buildings. And, you know, this has come up a lot. For one of the first interviews I did, they asked if it was air conditioned, and I said no. And basically then it became this, you know, this building in the desert doesn't need any AC. But the more, I actually gave a talk in India, in Mumbai, and basically it was mostly an Indian audience. And somebody said, you know, why haven't you given these girls air conditioning? Do you not think that they're worthy of it? And basically everybody, and it was a very well-educated group, said we didn't have air conditioning in our building. And I think about in the U.S., I mean, I grew up on the East Coast. We didn't have any air conditioning. And, you know, even at the top tier Ivy League schools, they still don't have any air conditioning. Obviously, it doesn't. We don't have the same heats, the heat level, but, you know, it's starting to get up there. But fans work very well. And the way it's designed with the windows high up, circulation of the air, of the hot air, goes through and out the doors. So the construction of the walls, I went at in a very simple way. I basically asked questions of people who built there for centuries and how they managed to keep the buildings cool and how they managed to keep the buildings from the walls from falling over in this shifting sand condition. So my fancy education was put to the side, and I had to just start with, you know, what people call a beginner's mind and actually just be receptive to what they were comfortable using. I learned early on in my architectural career, somebody wiser said, you know, never ask somebody to do something that they're not comfortable doing. And yeah, you can push and stretch things wherever you are in this country, in any country, but like really you shouldn't have people work with materials they're not familiar with, they're not comfortable with, or, you know, but boy, these stone workers, these craftsmen, I mean, they are just like magicians with stone. For example, we wanted to use these oversized sinks and we were going to get them from Delhi and they were expensive, and the builder contractor said, what do you mean? We'll just carve them out of stone. Like carve this stuff like butter. And it's just, it's phenomenal to me. But our wall construction was basically what I asked them for a wall section, which we used, which was, you know, a composite of sort of a veneer cladding and then kind of an infill. And then we use the plaster on the inside for cooling. There's other features that I used. They have on all of their buildings, they have what I refer to as a sun canopy, which is over the windows, which basically stops the direct sunlight from coming in. They use it in common practice in many, many of their buildings. So I just looked at the buildings in Jaisalmer, asked questions what this is for, and used what they used. And I put it together in a way that was modern, you know, or contemporary. And I did that very intentionally because I knew that the craft was actually dying out. The sons were no longer interested in pursuing the stonework. and that I thought it'd be very valuable to be able to show that you can do something that's modern, that's contemporary, that's of our time out of stone. Instead of what typically is happening is they go to steel and glass because that looks like it's modernized, it's Western or whatever, but it's just not the right material for this climate. So yeah, I learned from them. You know, it was a whole journey, and we didn't have money for an engineer for the first phase, but we had money for an engineer from the second phase. And you know, these ellipses that I had designed, I had worked with a great engineering company here in the US who volunteered their time and who are amazing reputation. But not surprisingly, they put a grid over the oval. Whereas I was working with this engineer in India, and he sent me his first image, a hoof in the sand. Of what the concept was. And he said, I'm going to use your design as the structure. And the gravity of the walls in the earth, like the hoof of the cow, will actually create its own support. So this gentleman used the shapes, because they are actually arches just on the ground, and the arch is a natural, structurally coherent form. So he looked at it in that way, and we came up with a very different structural system. So it's like, we all need to learn.
Inside, the classrooms were brought to life by local woodworkers and stonemasons, engaging the community and weaving the history of the region into the fabric of the institution.
The classrooms, because of the oval, are natural kind of amphitheaters in the sense that they're shaped, you know, with slanted sides like an auditorium towards the teacher. So, you know, that was another kind of discovery through the design process. And I needed these classrooms to be very, you know, they had to have natural light. And actually, we've been very lucky, the natural light, they barely turn on the overhead lights, because they get just this beautiful natural light. I mean, there's beautiful light in this area of the desert, but also we did the walls in lime plaster, which is used also as cooling, but also reflects the light in a really lovely way. And then, so that's the bulk of the spaces. And then there's a teacher's room. There is currently an art room, which is also very important to me. I think that the development of arts through education is very important. One of the goals of the foundation of the project was to involve community. So it was kind of also an interesting journey, because they kept saying, just order the school furniture from Delhi. And there's a town that you pass through called Kanoi on your way out to the school. And I was told that all of the men there, where most of the men there, migrated to Mumbai to work in furniture factories. And so I said, well, can't we use these guys next door? They're a 15-minute drive. If things need to be repaired or replaced or, you know, anything, they're here. They'll have a vested interest in it, because it's a point of pride for them. And it was very funny, because I couldn't find any. And I was like, I know in that village, there's somebody who can build these desks and chairs. And it took a long time of asking. And we found this father and son who indeed made the desks and chairs. And the benches, I used a Sharpei material, which is something they use kind of in these sort of beds that they use. So we use that in an unusual way. The wood was obviously from another part of India. But yeah, all local materials. You know, I believe simplicity can be extremely elegant. You know, fancy or complicated details and materials aren't necessarily the way to go. It's sort of like a sparkly gem on somebody's hand that, you know, you're attracted to, but it's not maybe what you need everywhere in the building. you know, like I said, budget was a concern, and we did do the identification for each of the classrooms out of flowers. And then on the donation wall, the people who donated to the classrooms, they were given a stone replica of this flower that identified the classroom. So, you know, when you go a lot of times to these buildings, you see these names on them, and, you know, which is fantastic. But it always is slightly jarring to me, because I immediately see and I think, like, oh, did that person actually ever come here? Like, do they know where this is? Do they know that it is here? Do they, you know, it's sort of, I think it takes the ownership of the building away from the people who need to own it, which is the kids and the teachers. So that was one area where we sort of splurged on carvings, was the stone carvings that identify each building. Again, with the lights in the classrooms, I, again, didn't want to import the lights from Delhi, because there's too many parts that can't withstand and that constantly are broken. They can't stand up to the temperature changes and the water and the sand. So for the lights, I wanted for the classrooms to be these big sort of hanging baskets. And you see baskets everywhere. And again, that was like an interesting thing, because getting someone to do a four foot wide basket was harder than you would think. And, you know, it was sort of like, I remember Michael going out to these villages and saying, well, look, you've made this basket here. You know, you can just do it bigger. And it takes, we all do this. It's a mindset. We're used to doing something in a certain way, and to flip it, you know, why would you do it that way? And I'm really learning, you just cannot stop asking questions and listening and asking questions and finding out why, and then in cases convincing them to do it the way that you're suggesting. So these basket lights were made, and they've worked, and they're very, you know, they were very inexpensive and natural to the environment. And the electrician who lives in Jaisalmer, you know, basically assembled them. So if there's any issues, again, he can address them. And then the lights on the outside of the building were, again, made with the same ideals. The electrician, again, who had done all of the wiring for the building, I said, here's the light fixtures I want you to make. And he said, I can't make a light fixture. And I said, well, you can wire to the location, and then we can work with the stonemasons to create the enclosure. And so there's back and forth. And then, first of all, I think it would have been incredibly, you know, inappropriate to have like these, like a brass light fixture in the building. So basically we use translucent white marble that's available locally, created kind of alcove and a place for a light fixture with this stone lens over it, and the electrician wired to the spot. And they're actually, the school is really beautiful at night. They, you know, one of the intentions, which I hope will be part of the program, was they were going to have kind of evening events that were, you know, dance or music or things like that. So the lighting in the desert is quite beautiful. And so they did three different kinds of light fixtures.
At the center of the school, a courtyard acts as a multifunctional gathering space for performances, a cafeteria, and even a gymnasium.
The courtyard is actually a natural amphitheater. And I've been told the acoustics at their morning assemblies are exceptional. It's an auditorium. And then the courtyard has steps that you can sit on to watch the performer or the person speaking. There's this incredible architectural feature that's, I don't think I've seen it. I've never seen it in other countries, which are these step wells that they used as wells for water. And so that to me, the referencing of steps for the kids to sit on was sort of a step well. And so that's your auditorium. And then the way they eat is not necessarily the way we eat. And actually, so there's a hut that was there before, which is the kitchen. And they have two meals a day, which is amazing that Cheetah can provide that. And they actually eat typically out on the sort of veranda outside of the classrooms. We don't have a shading device, so they're not doing that. But they sit down and then they're served. And actually, I was researching kitchens and cafeterias for this project. And I saw a photo of Bill Clinton in a line at sort of a cafeteria setting, which we're used to. And I was like, well, they do, you know, the people I was working with said that that's, you know, they won't have that. They don't typically, you know, they sit down and then they're served. And I said, well, here's Bill Clinton in the cafeteria line. And they were like, that's totally a prop that was done for the photo shoot or whatever, the photograph. Nobody in any schools in India eats like that. So I don't know if that's the case, you know, universally, but in these rural communities, that's how they eat. So there is no need for a cafeteria. I mean, it's a very simple building. It's got a lot of complexity in terms of the design, but in its function, it's a very simple building. You know, it's classrooms, a corridor, and that's it. And they actually use the courtyard as a gymnasium. So, and again, that's not something girls in general are encouraged to do. And actually, I fortunately had this amazing woman who calls herself Fit Girl, who contacted me, and we were in discussion for a while. And she was at the time, I think, sponsored by Nike. I don't know right now, but she said that she really wanted to volunteer in places like this. I mean, she has a pretty big name for herself as a fitness person, but the whole idea of mind body development is so important. And she actually said to me, you know, these girls in particular, because they've been mostly in their homes. The boys can go outside and run around, but the girls don't. So she said from a very basic way, they needed, you know, just balance and just really basic kind of physical development, because it actually leads to health problems later. And also it's mind stimulating. So she does all of her classes in the courtyard. And you know, the thing about it's all weather dependent in India. Basically, they have no rain except for during the monsoons. And the school holidays are arranged around the monsoons. That's starting to change because of the global warming. Basically, the monsoons aren't as predictable and the colder weather isn't as predictable. And even the sort of 7 years that I've been going there, it's suddenly gotten to be much hotter. So that's something that, you know, needs to be addressed. But basically they are, you know, they have an athletic warm-up, much like a yoga, every morning.
Diana cleverly incorporated rooftop recreational spaces. A play wall featuring a slide and lattice jolly walls was strategically designed to overcome cultural barriers.
I used the space on the roof as a place for them in cooler weather to sit up and have outdoor classrooms. They love to run around up there. You know, normally you have these kind of really ugly metal water coolers kind of sitting in the middle of the space. And obviously water, cool water is very important in the desert. And what I did is I hid them behind the wall and then just had the plumbing fixture go out to these circles that the kids can drink water from. And then the other space that I created is what I call the play wall. I had one amazing person here in the US working with me, and I realized I needed somebody in India. We had no money to do any of this, and I worked pro bono. My associate here was paid. And then we had this amazing woman jump on to volunteer, and I was discussing this play wall with her, and I had a big slide. And she said to me, it's not a cultural norm for girls to go down a slide. And I said, have you ever been to a playground? Do you find that the girls don't go down the slides? And she said, well, in this cultural context, they don't. So what I did is I used what they call jolly walls, which are these screens that women are typically hid behind in buildings, and they only observe activities that are on the streets or public forums and stuff through these screens. So I gave them a privacy screen, but it was blocks instead of this kind of intricate carving that they do. So they could go down the slide, basically. And that part still has to be worked out. Unfortunately, we got to the end of the project and sort of money ran out. So a lot of the things that were in my design haven't been completed. I hope that they will. We had, for example, two shading devices in the courtyard, which are not there, which I hope will be there at some point because it gets hot.
When it came to permitting the project, variations between the U.S. and India building codes led to a few unexpected surprises.
We got the government requirements for the school, the proportions of the schools. Actually, the second two buildings were for a library that they required and science labs and things like that. But that was another thing in the middle of the process. I learned that we didn't actually have to comply with those. Those were countrywide requirements. So the 20,000 that I had made space for wasn't necessary. So we had to do a quick change, and we decided to make that more of a museum space for the women's cooperative. That aside, I don't know how these men and women manage these stairs that are just like standard in India. They're stone, they're slippery, they do it so gracefully and in heels and like, you know, I've seen the royal families in saris going up and down these stairs like, you know, two-year-olds and with heels, and just it's amazing to watch. But, you know, we complied with the codes we're used to complying with to the point of one funny kind of cultural clash was our bathrooms, because we in the United States were designing for accessibility and a wheelchair clearance and all of these things. In India, they were like, you know, you don't need this. In fact, the result is a little bit like we made bathrooms for the Four Seasons, because comparatively they're oversized. And that's something we can change. You can always add more toilets, but the girls think the bathroom is like their playground. They've never experienced a bathroom like this or at all. So in the beginning we had some trouble. They were, you know, playing with the water. All of the only thing that's broken is all of the plumbing fixtures broke because they were overusing them. And so yeah, that's something we may alter in the future, just to add some more toilets, because they don't need this amount of space.
Things we would never think about here.
Yeah.
Would never, ever think about here, that being, you know, that reaction.
Right. I mean, in school, how did you feel about your bathrooms? You probably were like, ugh, don't really want to go in there.
Yeah, exactly. Sure as heck didn't want to go in there and play. As the project moved into construction, one wall became the focus for Diana, and that design relied on accurate execution of the foundation.
They got the foundation perfectly. There was one wall that's actually not as drawn, that's on a slightly different angle. But otherwise, you know, that's the main thing. I was like, all I care about, or all that needs to happen here is the foundation goes in correctly. You know, the rest, obviously there was a lot more than that, but like, you know, they don't use instruments. They do so many things by eye. They put this foundation in, and it was exactly to the design. And that, I think, is the design challenge that, like, you know, blows away any of the other design challenges.
What do you have to do differently to do a foundation in the sand?
Well, they build it kind of like a pyramid out of stone. Instead, we typically do a vertical with a footing. So it's like a upside down T. They, because you know, of the pressures of the sand, which actually can help support the building because the sand is, you know, continually pushing in on the structure. So this pyramid is what we used. It's sort of stacked solid stone. You know, we in the US use all sorts of, you know, technical instruments and things, and they just had their way of doing it that they used. You know, to me, that's incredibly profound. And, you know, it's for me, this has been life-changing.
Keenly observing the construction process, Diana came to trust the local builders and their methods that might otherwise be considered unorthodox here in the United States.
I chose to take sort of a personal interest and actually visit the site because I think so often, and, you know, I was at a place in my life where I was able to do that. And so, you know, I think showing up, like in general for anything, like this isn't my brilliant words of wisdom, but showing up, period, is always something. So it showed that I cared by visiting. There was interesting communication issues. I mean, from a construction point of view, one of the things that I actually was trying to insist that they do was a cavity wall. Lori Baker, who had come up with this notion of a cavity wall for thermal insulation, which is basically using air as an insulator, famous throughout India. Their techniques are, you know, known by everyone. And I actually was on the phone on a Zoom with this contractor, and I was talking about the cavity wall. And I was saying, you know, we really need to have this, and showing him pictures of Lori Baker's buildings. And he was getting more and more frustrated and agitated. And, you know, I didn't know why. And, you know, eventually he hung up. And I was like, oh, I guess we got to approach that differently. But the way they build, which is brilliant and makes sense, is not like us where we put, like, you know, the studs up and then the sheetrock on. They build the veneer stone first, which makes sense because that's the part that actually, from a design detail point of view, that needs to be correct. So I went to the job site, and there was along the foundation, there were these little dials set up, which were thick facade stone. Not really a veneer, like it's 4 inches or 4 inches, I think. And I was like, what's happening here? Like, you know, baffling to our way, my way of thinking, which is you build the back wall and then you put the facade on, right? But no, they do the facade and they get it perfect. And then actually one of the most phenomenal things was watching them. I was like, but it's uneven. And they said, no, we'll fix that. And I actually came back to the job site and they actually had I'm not even sure what you would call it, but some type of cutter. And they were doing it by eye. They were doing the height of cutting all of these stones to be level. And that's amazing too. I mean, I think, you know, I work in a very intuitive way, always have. And so to me, this is like the ultimate in intuition. Like, trust yourself. Your eye actually tells you a lot more than your instruments sometimes. And, you know, if you go back to the building of, like, you know, the ancient Greek and Roman temples, they adjust for the bending of the earth. So their building actually isn't horizontal. It's adjusted to the way it's seen by eye so that it's seen from far away as a rectangular building. But in reality, there's a word I can't remember, but, you know, adjusts for this. So I haven't done this, which actually would be interesting. If you took an actual measurement of it, I think you'd find it to be pretty completely accurate. But like, no, they just did it by eye. And, you know, I'm like, oh, okay, you got this.
I would have twitched. I would have been, I'm very analytical. I would have been twitching watching them do that. I just like,
I'm a slightly different kind of architect than a lot of people in that I believe firmly in sort of trusting the people who are doing the project. And if you actually give them that trust and if you give them that power, it actually makes for a better space. Obviously, there's the anal architect in me and, you know, everyone in my team from the US, it's like, they didn't get that detail right. They didn't do this, they didn't do that. And I'm like, they built it in 10 months. They built that building. And, you know, can you imagine anyone here? You wouldn't be able to find a stonemason here. I mean, they're not here.
The use of native stone and resourceful construction techniques was not only cost-effective, but inherently sustainable.
Stone in Jaisalmer is very, very pliable. So, and it's actually, it's not really even quarried. It's so close to the surface that it's not this kind of environmentally damaging quarrying process. Suddenly I became this sustainability person, but really what I was doing was going back to their techniques and using common sense and also, you know, being guided by the fact that there was a limited budget and, you know, the dollars spent on the materials or anything else were dollars away from the education for these girls. So people say India needs to be sustainable. It's like, we do. They got this down. I mean, there's in these communities that I'm in, nothing's thrown out. I mean, everything is reused. And I mean, all the tiles on our roof were discarded ceramics. And actually, I've gotten questions, as you know, when you do a publication in the United States, you have to list where the materials are from and blah, blah, blah. And people were like, how can I get those tiles? As though they could go to Ann Saks and, you know, buy them or something like that. And I'm like, they're recycled. And they're like, yeah, I know, but like, how do I get them? I'm like, you go to where the village deposits their pottery and you select pieces and you reuse them in your construction. And that's just a lifestyle. And we don't have that lifestyle, you know, because we're so spoiled and we have so much abundance that, you know, our thinking is just different.
Undoubtedly, this project encompassed a variety of valuable lessons, ranging from navigating environmental challenges posed by the desert to bridging cultural divides and effectively communicating a shared vision. These lessons illuminated a path for Diana and crystallized how to expand her impact for projects to come.
It was very interesting. It was a real eye-opener for me. You know, I had, you know, one of the best architectural educations available in the world at Columbia University, but no one had taught me how to do a foundation in the desert. There were, you know, just sort of physical things that were difficult. You know, you would be standing reading your plans and there'd be sweat all over them. And then suddenly your phone would die and, you know, because it was too hot and all kinds of things like this would happen. And then sand would be in your eyes and like, you know, all kinds of just sort of things that culturally I'm not used to. And so I had to adapt to those things. And, you know, there was, you know, we used different terms for, like, I was saying lintel meaning something, and they were saying lintel meaning something completely different. So, in general, they're not accustomed, at least in this part of the world, to have very specific drawings that they follow. I mean, that's not universal, but it is part of the process. So, one of the things we did is my colleague, Basha, put together an animation of the building. And it was this incredible experience to watch the main builder, Karim Khan, see the walkthrough through 3D goggles while I was standing there in the desert with him. So to have this incredible like connection between New York and this rural community was through technology was just amazing. And he actually was looking through the 3D goggles and he like took them off, had a big smile on his face. He's like, now I understand. And that obviously is an incredible tool we have now, which we use to explain buildings to clients and to explain to builders. It's the juxtaposition between this very remote rural place and, you know, the bustling city was just this kind of, it just felt like magic. It was like, you know, you can do so much. I mean, that's another thing that I've really learned, especially during COVID, because I couldn't travel. There was so much that we could accomplish remotely through video. And, you know, obviously there's no comparison to being in the place, but I had already spent a lot of time there. I think, you know, a lot of architects tend to actually never visit when they do these schools in different countries. You know, I insist that we visit, and I insist that if possible, the people working on the team can also visit. I actually, because of all of this work that I've done, and because I'm having so many requests for more projects and so many letters from young architects, particularly women, but also men, saying, you know, I want you to mentor me. I want to learn how to use my skills for the betterment of society. I want to learn, you know, I'm a passionate architect, but I want to make this into something like what you've done with the school. So I've sort of gathered all of those names and then gathered all of the names of the people reaching out to me, and they're, you know, all over the globe. I think I'm moving into Africa, the next stages. I've got other projects going in India, and I'm actually starting a nonprofit for basically the services that we've been providing, which is, you know, design services, sort of helping these NGOs who are all heart and all intention, but don't know how to kind of take it from step A to step B. So I've just decided to put these people, you know, put the students together with the NGOs. And my team in India knows how to do this now. And we've developed different principles that are important to do this. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see where this goes.
The Rakshamari Ratnavati Girls School opened in November 2021. And caters to over 400 girls, ranging from kindergarten to class grade 10. Here, education is not just a privilege, it is a lifeline, a gateway to economic independence that will echo through generations. Mona Sinha sheds light on the hope to replicate this school and its potential in other parts of India or even the world.
Well, I think the project was dreamt to be bigger than just a school, because I think there was some ideas of building a space where women could gather. There was also an exhibition space imagined there, because when I saw it, there were drawings in the school area which had three buildings. So I'm sure that there's some expansion possibility going on. And I do believe that's something that they are pursuing. The idea that you could create a community and you could create something that could envision the possibility for it to be replicated in either other parts of India or even in other parts of the world was exciting to me. Because we can invest in education, which we all must do, but the importance of a space to learning and space to dreaming is something that often, you know, does not get done. And I think it will pay dividends, which we have yet to see, but it's already changed the pride of these young children coming to school, who probably would never have gone to school or would have gone to like a local school where, you know, they weren't a priority. So for these little girls to come to a space to be valued, to be honored, to have beautiful uniforms, to have a beautiful space in which they could run around and be completely free and have an imagination to learn through the arts and to be in a space that is so artistic itself, I think is inspiring to them.
Beyond its aesthetic allure, the Rakshamari Ratnavati Girls' School stands as a symbol of progress and inclusivity. It is a haven where dreams are nurtured, talents are honed, and futures are shaped. I am just amazed by this school, and I really enjoyed this conversation with Diana. I hope this episode sparks a new idea,
helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
Actually, to be honest, like, I thought this was a building no one was ever going to see. And that, like, you know, it probably enabled me to be sort of very relaxed about it, in the sense that I knew who my client was the NGO, but really the girls, period. And I know what a girl is, and I have a girl, and I was a girl, and whatever. So, you know, that was the main focus. But there's something about that, having that impact, and, you know, the people that have contacted me to say, I want to you to mentor me, which, of course, I don't feel like I'm in any position to mentor anybody. I'm just making daily, sorting things out based on what I know and asking the right questions of how to proceed. And I guess I had decided a while ago, there was a reunion statement that you had to make for my college. And I actually said I was at a crossroads in my career, and I was going to decide whether to continue to make buildings for people who really didn't need more buildings. They already had homes in the second, third, fourth homes for not a necessity. Or I was going to turn to my art and work only in the studio. Or I said I was going to make my children my secret agents of change. And this was a long time ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago or something. And I've actually done all three. And I really, really have all my faith in the next generation and in my children. I'm biased towards them. They are actually, I have a board of my nonprofit. It's called Terra, which means where the light emanates. And on my board is my very good friend who actually set up the nonprofit, and my two children. And so I didn't ask them. It wasn't a choice. But if it actually takes off and goes somewhere, they're going to be the guardians of creating this change through what I have as a skill and what many people have as a skill, which is our abilities and talents as architects. And so I'm counting on them.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.